Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
In this first episode, I bring to you Cole Butler, an experienced physiotherapist who works with elite athletes, including those in the Olympics. We talk about everything from injury rehabilitation to injury prevention and more. Hi, Cole. Thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. Nice to have someone as experienced as you coming on. And obviously, I needed someone to help out with the physio side of things. So I just want to say thank you for coming on. And if you can just introduce yourself, that'll be amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, firstly, thanks for inviting me on. So I always like doing these sorts of things. It's good to have a chat. So my name's Carl Butler. I'm a senior physiotherapist at the UK Sports Institute and currently head of athlete health for GB Aquatics. So I oversee the medical and physio teams for British swimming, British Paralympic swimming and British diving. I've been in this role for a couple of years now, been in Olympic sport since 2009. So done London, Rio, Tokyo and now going into Paris in a couple of weeks. Prior to that, I was in professional football for 12 years. So I've got a bit of experience in sports physio.
Yeah, definitely got the right one of the best people around, definitely in the UK at least, to be talking about this topic. Yeah, thank you so much. And I'd just like to put it out there, Carl's helped me loads with my own injuries. Like, I couldn't do an overhead shoulder press about a year and a half ago, and now I can. So, yeah, thanks. So heard a little bit about yourself, obviously clearly experienced. And obviously, you said you were in footballing once upon a time as well. So, yeah, different fields as well, which you incorporate your skills into, which is obviously very handy. So, seeing as you're very much in the trenches very often, can you go into what are the most common injuries you see in patients who engage in strength and resistance training? Because a lot of the clients that I have, and the people that are listening to this tend to be into resistance training themselves.
Yeah, for sure. I think the biggest one with resistance training, you're talking about a closed skill, pretty much. They know what they're going into. There's no surprises, you know, short of dropping a dumbbell on your foot or those sorts of things. But I think the biggest one are training load errors. I think that's probably the biggest area we see problems. So people come to me and say, oh, I started weight training a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago, and all of a sudden my shoulder starts to hurt or my back hurts. Or something else. When you dig down, they're basically ramped up too quick, too soon, or too often. So they're doing too many steps through the week overall compared to what they were previously. So that jump in numbers is just way too fast for the body to adapt. And they get overused type injuries. So sort of tendinopathies, muscle strain tears, those sorts of patterns. They're probably the main ones we see predominantly, with people around resistance training.
Okay, cool. So what would you say are good strategies to maybe prevent something like one of these injuries around the shoulders specifically happening in the gym? What strategies do you have?
I think that the best thing to do is have a plan to start with. I think come and see someone like yourself and just say, okay, well, here's my goals. Create a goal. What do you want to achieve from starting strength training, resistance training is, or any form of training to be fair, but having, if you've got a clear plan, start as you would do with any plan. You create a goal. Where do you want to get to? What do you want to do? It may just be get stronger, which is fine. Okay. That's where are you now? So establish the baseline and then you essentially do a gap analysis. Where do you want to be? Where are you now? How do you get to that point? And then you can systematically plan your progressive overload to get to that goal or get to that, whatever you want to achieve. And I think that's probably the most sensible thing. So once you've set your plan, you then put those stage goals in and you could do it over 6 weeks, 6 months, depending what the goal is. You know, if you're dealing with someone who wants to get fit for the summer and you're in January, that, you know, you've got a 6 month window there or 5 month window. So you can plan it around that. I've had people before say, I'm getting married in 9 months. I want to get in shape Or I've got a bad back, so I want to get in the gym and get into shape. How can you do it? So you just basically, you use the timeline that they give you. And it's got to be realistic. If someone says, oh, no, I want to be massively in shape in 2 weeks time, and if they haven't trained for 10 years, you're going to go, well, that's not going to happen. So I think just having a clear plan, clear awareness of where they are, where they want to be, and you just create those step goals with small increments. And as a general rule, I'll probably look at 10, 20% increases at a time. That could be weekly, 10 days, 2 weeks at a time. And that's just a nice little guide just to give them an idea of what those step goals look like in terms of progression.
A lot of people like using numbers. So 10 to 20% is a nice, easy number to work around, because a lot of people, you get a lot of good advice from different practitioners. But end of the day, no one's specific enough, or if they are specific, it's more specific towards go buy my ebook. Go buy my
Exactly.
Yeah. So appreciate that massively. And then speaking about obviously injury prevention and exercise and exercising with progression as well. How important is it to have proper form whilst executing different types of exercises, and what tips do you have in terms of maintaining those mechanics?
I think it's important. I think it can be overemphasized too much. I think that can be a danger, but it's definitely important. I think obviously certainly for someone starting out or someone ramping up load and going up a notch, they certainly need to focus on form and how well they lift or move weight. But again, one of the things is just to tread that fine line between too much. You see people bracing lots and just really trying to hold rigid, unnatural positions. And when we move in the real world, we don't move naturally and well. And you see people lifting boxes in all sort of ways, shapes, and forms. Delivery guys picking boxes out of his van. And that's fine if they're adapted to that. And I think that's something we just got that's a nuanced part to this answer here, is that yes, it's important. But in real life, we don't do that all the time. So it's okay sometimes to have ugly reps and to train ugly, because that's what life is. And it depends who you've got in front of you. If you're dealing with a weightlifter who's going to go in and do competition lifting, then yes, form is important because they're lifting serious load. But if you've got Joe Public who just wants to get fitter and stronger to do whatever, like lift his kids up, whenever you lift a child up, it's not in perfect form because they're wriggling around like anything. So it's context and environmental specific and person specific to the person. But as a general rule, form, you do need to focus on good form, but with the nuance in that there is variation around that.
Yeah. So you're saying, so for example, if someone is new to the gym and they're coming in for the first time now, maybe focusing on the form first, but not being afraid to take them out of their comfort zone and being too specific with form every single time is probably not the best, because it's not action specific to the real world, is what you're basically saying.
Exactly that. And also, people move different, and I think that's something when you talk about open chain exercises, free weight exercises, people can do the same exercise and look different and move different, and we've got to work with that. And you go, okay, well, actually no one moves the same, so I think that's the license we've got to give people, their own license to explore how they move and how best they can shift weight effectively for them. Within the constraints of safe form, and I think that's the difference there, is they've got to be safe, clearly, and they don't want to do themselves harm from it, but actually people move differently, so giving them, let's say, that bandwidth to explore how they move is a good strategy.
Amazing. Love that. All down. I love you pointed out context always, and relevance.
Always.
Super important. So next, something I'm genuinely interested in is the role of warm-ups and cool-down routines and injury prevention. So I'm talking like different stretches, and then even I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but besides the warm-up perspective, obviously getting blood flow to the muscles, etc., is can that aid your lifts as well from a physiotherapy perspective? I'm not sure if you know the answer to that.
There's two parts to that question. One is the injury prevention part, and then the two is the performance part. So in terms of the evidence base around injury prevention for warm-ups, there's very little. There's a lot of low-level evidence, and the weighting is towards, yes, it does help prevent injury, but there's no high-quality evidence to categorically say, yes, by doing a warm-up, you're going to reduce injury risk. So we can't categorically say that, but if you've trained and you've lifted, which I know you have and I have, is I have to warm up. I can't go into a max lift or any sort of high pace run or whatever without doing something beforehand. And there's several mechanisms that feed into that. Psychosocial, biomechanical, it's physiological. All those things need to all be in sync. So you can't just get off the sofa and go and run. Well, you can, but, and that's where some of the low level evidence says, if you go and do that, the chance of tearing a calf or whatever, based on your predisposition, is higher. But I think I would always advocate some sort of warm up. Now, what that is, it's got to be specific to the task you're doing. So it's pointless going and doing a jog around a field if you're going to do a bench press, because you say, well, actually, you're probably just better off doing a bench press, but just stick on an empty bar. Just run through some movements with an empty bar first, get your brain tuned into the movement you're going to do, get the muscles fired up, get the neuromuscular complex going, stimulate your body in the movement you're going to do. So I think that is important in terms of warm up. But like I say, the evidence is low in terms of injury prevention. But from a performance perspective, that's different. There's more of a weighting towards, yes, it improves performance. So things like, there's loads of evidence in research in basketball talking about jump height and change of direction. So doing any plyometric, almost like potentiation type exercises beforehand, does actually excite the neuromuscular complex. So you get faster firing rates and you get more stiffness through the tendon. So you can actually improve performance. So, there's less evidence on the injury prevention side, more on the performance side for warm-ups for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. I see that with my own training. I can quite literally feel that if I'm going up to, so December went up to 200 kg squat, there's no way I could go do a 200 kg squat straight off the bat. Have to build myself up to that. Whereas in terms of injury prevention, like you said, I could get up and just go for a run, but it'll take a bit of time to get the pace out of it if I were, as opposed to just warming up first and then going for the run. Again, it is context and relevance. So thank you for answering both sides of that so specific as well.
Just a quick break. If you find this information useful, please like, subscribe, and send this to a friend. Otherwise, let's get back to the conversation.
The next thing I wanted to ask you was, how do you advise clients to progress their resistance to avoid overuse of injuries? So, yeah, go on.
Got it. The first part of that question, to avoid overuse, I think, again, it comes back to a plan. Have a clear plan. I think if you've got an end goal, you've got a baseline, you know where you are right now. And I think that's the key thing people also miss, is establish where you are right now. So people underload, they do 6 weeks of really light load and think, oh, great, and then jump up 50%. So you go from, a 50K back squat, and all of a sudden you're jumping up to 100. That is not a realistic jump in the space of a week, even 2 weeks or even 3 weeks. So have that clear progressive plan in your mind. Seek help, seek someone like yourself to go, okay, I want to achieve this. This is where I am. And they might not know how to establish where they are. So people like, you come in and you basically assess them. So one, how do you move? Can you move well? Can you do it in the first place? Because if you can't, let's pick squat. If you can't do a barbell back squat without good form and you're all over the place and you can't organize your body to hold a bar on your back, probably a barbell back squat is probably not the best target for you. We might need to do something else. We might need to progress it to a bodyweight squat or a heel elevated squat or, sit you in a Smith cage or just to start with leg press. So it's those sorts of conversations first to go, not it's exercise or outcome specific, and you can get there differently with different exercises. And also dosage specific. So we're talking about loads in terms of reps, sets, frequency, duration, all those kind of things. All of those have to be tailored individually for the person at the time. Then you've got a clear goal of where you want to be at the end of that plan, and then reverse engineer it. Go, okay, well, how do we get to that plan? What are the step goals we've got to get them? If you stick to that with a bit of variance, because some days you feel crap, you go into the gym, you think, okay, yesterday I did X amount for X amount of reps. I've had a rest day and now I'm going to go again today. And you come in and I just feel terrible, which is a pace that we all do. You might just go, well, actually, I'm just going to either maintain or just drop it a little bit, just to maintain the habit, maintain the stimulus. But I'm just going to go, okay, it's just a maintenance day today. I'm not going to try and push, because sometimes it's not a great thing to push through when you're not feeling it.
Yeah, that's exactly where injuries happen. And also, exactly. I suppose the repeated bout effects of like the neuromechanical matchings, just so that your brain and body understand how to work together in conjunction, just to make sure you don't hurt yourself. Like I think so many people I know of who will be like, oh, I need to come to the gym 6 days a week. I have to come in 7 days a week. Like I'm trying to get my goals. It's like, it's actually doing the opposite effect. You're actually tearing down the tissue too much. And then the fatigue becomes so high that you've got this bar now on your back, and then something twinges, that's it. Your lower back's done. You hear it all the time with squats, especially.
Yeah, exactly that. I think there's another challenge there around, when you've got people who aren't in the gym full time. So people like me and you work in sport or work in those sorts of environments full time. That's our job. But other people have office jobs or they work at home. They sit in an office for 6-7 hours a day, or they have to work away. So they're away for 3 days. They miss 3 days of training, or, the gym session might be in the middle of those 3 days they're away. So they come back in on the Thursday and say, right, I'm going to catch up. They do, right, I've missed my Tuesday session. I'm going to do two sessions in one day, or two sessions in 2 days, and go max on both them days. The body doesn't work like that. And it doesn't work to your schedule. It still responds, the cells in the tissue respond the same way, regardless of your work schedule or your life schedule. So don't try and catch up. I think that's one of the other things I would say in terms of we try and avoid injury is if you miss a session, just put it to the back and say, right, I've missed it. I'm not going to try and catch it up. If you can rearrange your week to get it in sensibly where you've got a recovery day in between, then fine, but certainly don't try and clump it up towards the end of the week to try and get your reps in for that week.
Absolutely, 100%. That is a rookie mistake. I still see people, I'm talking about natural lifters specifically, who've been training for 5 years and they just say, like, I'm just not making any progression. It's because they're training exactly like what you're mentioning. Yeah. And yeah, rest is where we're actually making the adaptations. We're putting the body under stress. Rest is where the adaptations happen, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the people either don't know or don't realize or just forget or ignore. I think that's the key thing. Recovery is as important as the training itself.
Absolutely. It's not about training hard, it's about training smart in all contexts of exercise and sport.
Exactly.
So what is your approach to rehabilitating a patient who has sustain an injury from training is my next question.
I think it's just essentially the same concept. It's the same concept. So I think the first thing is if someone gets injured, I would encourage them to carry on training as much as they can with the constraints of, unless they've got the whole body, total body injury, which you're not going to have. You're not going to injure all your joints all in one go. You're going to injure normally one joint or one area of the body. That area needs to be protected initially. So obviously one, it's managing symptoms things. So if you've got pain, swelling, and reduced mobility, all those sorts of things, deal with them. But by dealing with them, you've got to kind of protect it, prevent it from further harm. And then basically you're going to go, right, okay, well, let's say this person trains 3 or 4 times a week normally. Maintain that 3 or 4 times a week if it's feasible to. I mean, protect the injured area, but stay in the gym because you're keeping that neuromuscular stimulus going, which is actually beneficial for the injury itself. So that's the first thing I would say is don't people just go, okay, I'm injured now, I'm going to stop doing everything. So let's say they're into their shoulder, for example. They just stop going to the gym because they're into the shoulder and they forget that both their legs and the other arm and their core still work. And I think that's one of the biggest errors. First off, when anyone gets injured, they just stop. They just completely stop. So the body's had this stimulus building up, and all of a sudden it just stops. And they might do that I've rested my shoulder for 6 weeks. And they get back in the gym, shoulder feels better, but it's obviously weak, so they've not rehabbed it. I'll come on to that in a sec. And then they go and train and injure something else because the body's just detrained for 6 weeks and they try and pick up where they left off. So I think that's an important concept to get into people when I first see them, when they're injured, they say, well, the rest of your body still works. If you're used to exercise and carry on, because that habitual process is actually beneficial for long-term healing. And then what you do is you shoehorn that injury into their training routine. So you say, okay, well, like I said, when someone's injured, they don't always return to baseline. So just because you've injured your shoulder doing an overhead lift, let's take your example, doing an overhead lift. If all the movements below shoulder height are actually pain-free, don't stop doing them. So instead of completely resting your shoulder, you go, okay, well, what actual movements is your shoulder, what's problematic for your shoulder for that injury? So normally an injury is either direction specific or load specific. So basically you can't tolerate an overhead lift. You can't take a heavy overarm lift for sure. So it's okay, let's take overhead out of the equation, but you can do a low row. Perfect. Let's keep the rest of the muscles. Say you've injured one or a couple of muscles in your shoulder out of multiple muscles around the shoulder. You go, okay, well, work the rest of the muscles because they're actually, again, beneficial. You're getting blood flow, you get a neuromuscular activation around the shoulder, which promotes healing. So again, it goes against this mindset of going, when something's injured, you have to protect everything. You put this massive cordon around it to go, right, a big red flag flying on this shoulder. I can't use my shoulder. And that creates so much more problems further down the line. So first off, I'll go, right, let's explore what you can do, rest of the body and the injured limb itself. If you can't do anything, fine. I mean, let's say if someone's fractured their limb, obviously they're going to be in plaster cast for 6 weeks, then that's a different story. But when we're talking about the tendinopathies and the muscle tears and strains that we were talking about earlier from resistance training that are most common injuries, I would advocate get it moving early. Obviously deal with symptoms, pain, swelling, all the rest of it. And that normally takes, that's all done within 72 hours, 3 or 4 days. But then get it moving. And then basically what you do is you phase up, you work the rest of your body and you phase up the injured area to match the rest of your body. And then you carry on training. And that's the basic principle. So you build the physical blocks around that injury. So the basic thing is mobility. Normally when you're injured, you lose mobility. So the first thing is let's restore mobility. That's your first simple goal. And that may involve stretching, some gentle active range of movement. That may involve some light isometric or easy movements. Then you get force production. So can you actually put some gentle force through it? The force production, as in strength, comes anywhere from a 25% effort isometric push, which is very light. It's basically me doing that against my hand and pushing for a shoulder. Nice and simple. You can start that from day one. That gets the neural and muscular components going as of, once the pain and symptoms allow you, which is normally day 3-4. Get that going early. And then once you started on that journey, that's the very bottom of the ramp of building up strength, right to the point where you can pick up a 30K dumbbell and put it over your head. That, again, you reverse engineer that whole movement. So it's about building up the blocks. And then where you finish depends on their goal. If they want to get back in the gym and lift, that's your end goal. So you can dumbbells overhead, for example, like in yourself, do no head lifts or overhead push. If it's someone like a javelin thrower, obviously they've got that whole other end of their rehab journey to do, which is basically returning to sport, returning to training and then returning to competition, which are three extra levels you'd put on top of someone, just getting to basic physical function. But essentially, you work the building blocks, you build them up, keep the rest of the body going, build that injured area back up to where it was pre-injury, essentially.
Yeah, so from a physiological perspective, I'm quite interested in physiology. Part of my master's was physiology. And when we break down, when we're injured, essentially atrophy is happening as well. So if you put into a cast, for example, now people think that when it comes to hypertrophy, everyone sprouts out mechanical tension, which is true, but it's mechanical tension against the force velocity curve, right? So drop in increased force or strength, most unit recruitment, velocity curve starts to drop down. So those fibers start to reduce and people think that it's just down to this mechanical tension. Now lifting a pencil is causing mechanical tension. And what can happen is after you're thinking like, okay, no hypertrophy can happen from that because I pick up a pencil every day and I don't make loads of gains. But if you break your arm and you have the pencil every day and it often has been in the cast for 4 months or whatever long it's been, you're going to see muscle gain. And this is something that needs to be remembered all the time when it comes to progressive overload and hypertrophy. Coming back from injury is that we need to keep the movement just so that our body can remember how those adaptation processes essentially happen. I think too many people literally do exactly what you say. They just stop the gym completely and they start from square one all over again. They're going to push themselves as hard as what they did before, but the body's not ready for that. And then injury just happens again and again and again. It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, definitely. I think the psychological part of that is much as anything. So, it's some people getting them to habitually train for the frequency and duration they need to for a week is a challenge. And they get that built into their lifestyle or something that comes a habit, which is a great habit to build. Breaking that cycle can be a massive detriment to them because if they're 6 weeks off in a cast, for example, or 6 weeks out, but then they have to get back on that wheel. But obviously their life's changed and the components have changed. So the psychological and the psychosocial element of that is as much as anything as the physical.
100%. So moving on from that, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. So this is actually going to be my next question, which you've essentially covered anyway. But if you want to go on from it, then please do. So can you provide an example of rehabilitation program for a common resistance training injury, like what you've already mentioned, like a rotator cuff injury or lower body or limb injury? You don't have to go into detail, but something nice and brief would be cool.
I think we take all the context of stuff that I just put in that last answer aside for a second, just concentrate on, let's say, a shoulder. So rotator cuff, keep it nice and rotator cuff tear on the shoulder. What normally happens is when you lose power, because basically the tendon's got a tear in it and it loses its contractile ability, normally because of pain inhibition. So in the early stages, you go, okay, well, you've got pain inhibition, which basically causes weakness or perceived weakness, because it can't fire as well. So first thing is restore range. Restore, if you've got really stiff and so you can't get into certain ranges, just actively do that. Just actively move through range. Or it might be a few passive stretches and all the rest of it. Just basically restore the normal movement you have in the shoulder. That's the first building block of it, really. Once you've got pain under control and then the early symptoms have subsided. Once you've got range back, work on strength. Get on the strength continuum. Like, and that could be the very, we've talked about muscle voluntary contractions, MVCs. We do that for isometric exercise. For isometric, you might just get a simple band like this and just push out against it. And you can do that. It's hard, 100%. 25, 50, as hard as you want, as hard as you can tolerate. And I think that's where it becomes specific. You say to the person, push until you feel a little bit of discomfort in the shoulder. And once you feel that point, just back off a touch there. That's your exercise for now. Work on the edges of pain, because you're going to get a little bit of discomfort, but manageable discomfort is okay. Just work on the edges of pain, push there, and just keep doing that. And you go, how long can you hold that for? It might be 10 seconds, it might be 50 seconds, 60. But you go through that stage and really, 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 really early. And they get used to that. And what that does is that breaks down the fear barrier. Because they go, actually, I can't move it. My shoulder's not going to fall off. It's not going to be massively more damaged because I'm moving it. You're just encouraging that movement. So then that starts your journey. Once you're on that frame, they get that fear. Because there's fear inhibition as well. People just get fearful of it and they don't want to move it. And part of my job, certainly when I see people have been injured for quite a while or recurrent injuries, is breaking down fear. I get them moving. I get them off the bed straight away and say, right, let's move it. Let's load it. Let's see what it can tolerate. Because it will be able to tolerate stuff. Because we use it everyday life. It's just painful. Let's get to the bit where we can just be under the radar of pain, but move it. What can we do and explore that? And that's where we start. And then once you're on that journey, it's just the building block of exposing it to more and more and more stuff, back to full function. That's where we move from early isometrics. You go to concentrics, eccentrics, dynamic movement, isotonic movement. You go for shoulders, keep it somewhere below shoulder height, and you can move above shoulder height, for example. Then you can bring in the chain, because kinetic chain movement, so looking at lunging and rotate, all those different components of movement, which is also really, really useful to put in. So when you talk about a shoulder problem, the lower limb is 50% of the force production for the, and the trunk is 30%, and only 20% actually comes from the shoulder. So wow. Actually, if you're doing a full kinetic chain, if you're dealing with a thrower or a tennis player, badminton player, half of their stability comes from the lower limb. So if you're just focusing on the shoulder doing banded stuff like this, it's fine early on. But if you're not integrating that into the full chain by the end of the thing, that they're not going to be ready, because basically the body's not synced up. So that's the basic thing. Start early, build them up, get them moving early, deal with symptoms, and then push them through that chain, essentially all the way back to whatever their goal may be for fitness.
Wow. Every day is a school day. I just learned a bunch of stuff there. That's super cool. How do you determine when a patient is ready to return to the regular resistance training routine after an injury?
So I think this is a nice thing about having a plan, because you should be able to tell any point in time where a person is on their journey, on their plan, because you've got this stepwise progression. You've established their baseline, you've established their end goal, and all you're doing is basically pushing them through those stages. And if you're hitting those stages at each point, then you know if you've got a goal of lifting, I don't know, 100k back squat, let's keep it simple, 100k back squat, you're currently at 80, so my maths can work there, that's 80% of where you want to be. You've got 20% deficit just to make up. So you can say, well, okay, you're probably at the latter end of the intermediate phase of rehab. If you break rehab into three stages, early, intermediate, late would be 100%, that's your return to fitness. That's how you can map them. So when they're going through those stages, you know exactly where they are. So the end point's easy, because once they're at 100%, you're saying, right, okay, now you're in a maintenance phase. Because normally by then, if they're lifting 80% or 80k in a back squat, they're probably going to be pain-free. If they're painful, they wouldn't be able to do it. So having that plan just allows you just to gradually take them through. And at any one point in time, you know where they are. So the end goal's easy because it's obvious.
Brilliant. So simple, effective.
It needs to be.
So how do you modify resistance exercises for patients recovering from an injury to prevent re-injury? obviously there's like an education process.
Definitely an education process. And I think that's the, for me, that's one of the biggest things when dealing with patients is the education piece. Make them understand the why. It's easy to give anyone, you know, someone comes in, is he's injured, and he basically says, right, here's the cheap exercises, go and do them. And you don't really spend the time with them for them to understand why. And it's, you know, when I talk to patients about their injury in the first place, that's when you see this moment of enlightenment because they're talking about their history. And I'm digging questions into, okay, well, what training load did you start? What have you been doing over the last 6 weeks? When did it ramp up? And they go, oh, yeah, actually, last week I did 3 extra sessions and I ramped it up for 40K. And I said, okay, that might be where the problem started. And you can see in their head that the light bulb come on. So I think digging down into that is the first thing, the education piece. So the modification piece is the monitoring bit we do in the middle. So we do this with our athletes all the time. We get subjective feedback from them. How did you feel? We use RPEs. We can use differential RPEs, sort of rate perceived exertion. How hard was that session? And how hard was that session on each area of your body? So if someone's got a previous injury of a shoulder or back, whatever it may be, you can ask them to do differential RPEs. So how was the shoulder in that session in terms of effort and how hard did it feel on that shoulder or your back or whatever? So they give us an arbitrary score of 0 to 10 and you can just map it. And sometimes when they're under recovered, they haven't slept well, nutrition's poor, they've just got lots going on in their life. Like some of our elite athletes are still at school, so they've got GCSEs and some have got A-levels, all those sorts of things. So during those times of stress, we actually go, well, actually, we might back you off a little bit at the moment in terms of load. So same principle applies to, you know, a private patient or a private client is if they've got stuff going on that's interfering with their ability to recover and they're not feeling it on that day, like we talked about earlier, just back off a little bit. It's okay. But backing off 10-20% is just the same as progressing 10-20%. You haven't got to back off to zero. You just back off enough that you can tolerate it because you're keeping the stimulus going. And you just you're not always going to make gains every single session. I think that's one thing to say as well. So just having that little bandwidth, and I call it flattening the waves. I say if you've got a stimulus, it gives a response. And if you can keep, you understand your bandwidth, you've got to play with that stimulus and response, then the stimulus is your load, your push, and the recovery is how you feel after it. And that's immediately after it, after the session, or even during the session in some cases, or the next morning, because that's when you're going to feel DOMS. If you're sore from a session, it's going to be the next morning or probably within that next 48 hour cycle. So you know you've done a hard session, the next 2 days you can't move, as in you're really stiff and sore. That's normal training response if you push yourself. But sometimes it's okay to get to that adaptation bit where you go, well, I'm just going to do a session that's just under my radar, that is low, but keeping enough stimulus to keep maintenance. But so recovery is going to be there, not as hard. And I can just keep the waves within my bandwidth that I can currently tolerate. Over time of training, that bandwidth gets bigger because you can tolerate more. And as long as your recovery is on point, you can keep recovering. So your waves stay waveform and even, but you just got control of it. And I think that's what I'd say in terms of modifying is don't stop it, just back off a little bit. Now you can regress the load or you can regress the exercise. Sometimes you're like, well, actually, my legs feel terrible, so my back feels, so I don't want to get under a bar to do a barbell squat. I'm going to do leg press instead. That's a simple progression. So there's various ways you can manipulate your load. Keep the load going, but just back off.
Yeah. So basically, just never stop exercising. Keep a stimulus, whatever kind it is, just keep the stimulus.
100%.
Yeah. Okay. So how do you incorporate other forms of exercise, such as cardiovascular or flexibility training into resistance-based rehab program?
I think that's context, person, and environmental specific. I think that this, I'll go through each of those. I think if the person wants to do strength training and has never done CB work or flexibility work before, you've got to then go, well, okay, well, why do you want to start it now? That's the first thing I'd say is if they're used to doing it and that was normal for them, then it'd be a case of going, okay, well, what did you do previously in terms of CV and flexibility, or what is your goal for that mode of training? And then the context and the environment is basically, have you got access to the stuff to do it? I think that's the other thing, because one of the things you've got to be realistic with the person. So a lot of patients I see either, you know, badminton players, tennis players, basketballers, or, you know, certainly my aquatics lot, they don't do, certainly with the non-elite sport, I stick with the non-elite athletes. Those guys might not go to the gym. They just go to basketball practice. And they go to badminton. So they go, well, I don't actually go to the gym. They say, well, try and integrate a whole load of gym work in there. That's not realistic because you're not going to go to the gym. So what have you got? What equipment have you got available to you at the basketball court, at the badminton court? And I said, well, basically, you've got a mat and a bit of area. That's it. So I tailor my exercises based on that. So I said, okay, well, cardiovascular for a big major speed jog around a court, or it might be some short speed agility quickness work. So the context of the environment is important to say first thing, but essentially you can fit them side by side. If they're doing resistance training in a gym and they want to do cardiovascular and flexibility, and it's they've done it before and there's a clear rationale as to why they want to do it, then you go, okay, well, let's be sensible about this. In the days after a heavy loading resistance training, you're not going to get much flexibility next day. Because chances are you're going to be working against your body. You're going to be stiff and sore next day. Or you should be if you're getting that adaptation when you're where it needs to be. So flexibility is going to be probably on the days where you've got a gap between your strength training. Cardiovascular, if you do concurrently. And it just depends on how they want to train. So basically, if you're going to do a CV session where you're going to go for a 20-minute run, you probably don't want to do that after a max hypertrophy leg session, because your legs could be jelly. So just thinking about the timing of stuff, and again, it comes into the context of the person, when they get access to the gym, when they can do exercise. So planning a rehab program will incorporate that, and just the awareness of, okay, well, the strength training is going to impact you in this way. Don't do when you can't do flexibility because you're stiff and sore, and you're just going to be working against yourself. Let your body adapt and recover. Two, your legs aren't going to tolerate cardiovascular work. So let's not do it on those days. Maybe let's do your CV work before a strength session. And then you've got to look at things in nutrition. That's where I look to someone like yourself to go, okay, well, how do we fuel around that? And then flexibility work is case of, well, if you want to get better, I say, hamstring range, you want to work straight leg raise or work hamstring flexibility, for example. Are you going to focus on a couple of big sessions a week where you're just focusing on that? Or is it better to microdose it through the day, through the week? So just do a little bit each day. And that might be part of your warm up, for example. So you might go, so if you're going to do a warm up, let's incorporate a little bit of flexibility work into warm up. But actually, what you might do is go, okay, well, as part of your warm up, you're going to do, let's say, a deadlift. That's the perfect way to actually get a weight under and do some loaded range work. So flexibility doesn't have to be static stretching. It can be working through decent range with a really low weight, because basically then you're still going to get the same response. You're going to get the muscle lengthening, and you get the joint range going through a bigger range as a development piece. So there's different ways of achieving flexibility. So you build it in based on their environment and their context and their individual needs.
Awesome. So that was amazing. Again, like, so specific. Appreciate that again. So I'm going to start wrapping up soon. So something else that I think comes up quite often. So everyone saw Anthony Joshua getting some cupping recently. So I think people are going to understand exactly where I'm going with this. So what common misconceptions do people have about injury prevention or rehabilitation? For example, things like cupping.
I think all of the things we just talked about, having the plan, having the understanding of why, is the most important thing. I think if you've got that foundation, you've got a really good quality plan, you're sticking to it, you're compliant with it, you've got really good step progressions, and you really understand what going into each session, what the focus is and what the goal is, that's your 95% of your rehab program right there. And to be fair, that's probably 95% of your ongoing training program right there. The cupping, all the other adjuncts on the end of it, all the electrotherapies, all those bits aren't going to put load into your body. So if you think about injury in a cause and effect perspective, you've got cause, which what's caused the problem in the first place, and the effect. The effects are symptoms. The effects you get from injury are the pain, the swelling, the weakness, all those things that come off the back of the injury. So things like cupping, it can make you feel better. It can make you feel better for 10 minutes, 2 days. It varies between people. And also it makes you feel better if you believe in it. So I think there's a placebo crossover effect in these things as well. They have a place. Don't get me wrong. They do have a place. I think when you see elite sports people like AJ and that getting it, we use it occasionally. Some of our divers who like it, some of our swimmers who like it. I was at a Pink concert the other day, my wife, and Pink had cupping marks all over her shoulder and K-tape on it, because clearly they have access to physios constantly. Every single day, most days, especially when we're on camps, we're with them every single day. And if we're with them that much, and we know that because we're overseeing their rehab and we're doing it constantly with them, then yes, those little things can be a 1% extra. Just makes them feel that little bit better. If that's just psychologically better, then fine, it's worth doing. But if a private patient comes in to see me and they're with me for 90 minutes, an hour, 90 minutes, I'm not going to spend 30 minutes of their paid time doing cupping, because they'll feel better for 2 days and then they'll go away and be back where they started because they haven't understood the loading part of it. So for me, loading people is the fundamental piece. If you're doing cupping and all these other bits without the fundamentals, you're wasting your time. You're just basically putting a plaster over a crack, and the crack's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger until the whole thing falls apart. So yeah, they have a place, but I don't routinely do that in my private practice just for that reason.
Amazing. Yeah. Basics first. Like, it happened to me before where I used to think cupping was great, and 2 days later, I was back to square one.
Exactly.
And then I got introduced to you, magic. Crazy.
So,
push myself so much harder. Honestly, it's hard to actually explain when a practice actually works. And the thing is that people tend to neglect when it comes to physio. You can't just go to a physio and expect everything to magically happen. You get the exercises and you have to do the work yourself as well.
That's the thing. That's the classic thing. Is people come to you and say, can you fix my back? And I said, no, I can't fix your back. I'm not a wizard. I'm not a magic wand to fix your back. You can fix your back and I'll teach you how. But the body will heal itself. It's how well it heals itself. It depends on the environment and what you do to it. Your body responds to the stimulus you give it. So if you train lots and you're strong and you do it progressively well, it's gonna give you payback, because it's gonna be much stronger, more resilient, more robust, and you're gonna get injured less. If you treat it like rubbish, that's what you're gonna get back. Constant problems. No one can come in and basically say, right, I've just massaged your back, now you're 10 times stronger and you're not gonna get injured again. Basically, massage your back, you feel better, and that's the dopamine hit you're gonna get from that session, because you feel better within the moment. You walk out and say, that feels amazing. But you're still weak underneath it. So 2 days later, you're still in back in going, I'm back to a sore again. I'm like, well, yeah, you didn't do nothing about it. I can make you feel better for an hour or 10 minutes. And that's coming back to the elite sport thing. That's what we do as practitioners in elite sport. Someone's got an Olympic final tomorrow. Of course I'm going to do a massage, because it makes them feel better. It makes them sleep better for the final tomorrow. We've done 4 years worth of training to get them to that point where they can cope with the load they're going to do in that final tomorrow. But if a massage or cupping makes them feel that 1% better, of course we're going to do that. That's our job. That's what we're there to do. But a private patient coming in who isn't doing none of that, he said, well, no, what's the point in cupping? You're going to feel better for 24 hours. Then it's going to go back to where it was.
Yeah. People talk to me about ice baths as another one, and they say to me, ice baths are really good for recovery. It's like, cool. Like, sure, they might help you recover quicker, but quicker recovery means less adaptation. So when you're doing the training for the adaptation process, that's different, like training for the big events. And then, like, I don't work at Olympic level, but if you were at the Olympic level and those guys have events back to back or games back to back, whatever it might be, then maybe something like what you're saying with the cupping, with the massages, with maybe an ice bath, just for that rapid recovery between bouts. Again, that's when the context comes. But if you looking to build muscle, increase your adaptation processes, become fitter, faster, whatever, maybe having those things should not be a focus at all. Focus on the basics as per usual.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, ice baths in training, we don't advocate that routinely in training for that reason. You need that stiffness and soreness. That's where you adapt. Good sleep. Sleep's the best thing ever. Just focus on your sleep. You've done 90% of the recovery you need to do.
Yeah. That, I'm getting someone on, hopefully, in not too distant future, specifically on sleep. So that's
sleep and nutrition. Yeah, do those things. You nailed it.
So, final thing I'm going to ask is, can you share a case study where your or intervention where you significantly improved a patient's recovery process?
I was thinking about this. I think there's probably a badminton player comes to mind. I think he came to me. He's a high level badminton player, amateur but high level, county level. Comes to me, he's had recurrent problems with his shoulder numerous times over the last couple of years. I had pain in his shoulder, inhibited ran competition time when his load went up. And we're kind of like, again, what I do with my patients when I first see them is spend a lot of time trying, just to try and find out the patterns. And as we were digging down and got deeper and deeper into it, he kind of sort of alluded that it was certain times in a game, it was in doubles, he'd always go down to revert, a backhand lunge. You know, when people are dropping the shot clock in low to the net, going backhand lunge, and that tends to be the most aggravating thing. He couldn't pinpoint it at the time, but as we weeded it out, he was saying he always kept doing this pattern. So I looked at that, I said, okay, well, is that the main driver? And he said, I'm not sure, because once that hurts, everything hurts, even overhand smash and forehands, they all sore as well. So I said, okay, well, let's take the first thing we've got a clue about is this backhand lunge. So, we said, let's have a look at the movement. So I've got a video up of, he happens to have a video of him doing the backhand, doing his game. And I found this video of him going to a backhand lunge. We can freeze frame that. So let's break that down into component parts. You've basically got, if we go back to the kinetic chain model we talked about, 50% from the lower limb, 30% from the trunk, 20% from the upper limb. When you talk about a full body movement. When you've got posterior cuff working, you've got posterior chain of the shoulders working to actually do the basically a lateral rotation through the shoulder with a bit of extension. So that, let's chunk that up. Let's look at thoracics. You've got, because you're going down to the position, you've got extension rotation going through the thoracic spine. You've got rotation going through the hip and you've got flexion through the trunk and you've got this lunge position. You're lunging on the right leg. So I tested all the joints within those buckets. I bucketed them up into shoulder, thoracic spine, hip and back. Tested all those component parts, and lo and behold, he had a massive deficit in his right hip compared to his left in terms of rotation and single leg stability. So we did a sit to stand test, nice, easy. Trunk rotation was massively down on the right, as was the extension, and his posterior chain testing, we tested his strength and his range for his shoulder, was really, really down as well. So we looked at it, and it was like, we talked about the limb symmetry index. I mean, no one's perfectly symmetrical, but it's a nice indicator when you're looking at left to right. It was at least 50% down on all of those markers. So I said to him, look, we don't know this is chicken egg. We don't know if this is because of your injury currently or that's how you've been over the last couple of years and you're just, just more vulnerable in that position because every other shot's fine. So we tested all the rest of the muscles and they're fine. So the balance was off around his shoulder. It just wasn't, based on the data I had for him, I was like, why don't we start here? Start with what we've got. The evidence we've got in front of us, these objective markers are poor. Let's improve all these objective markers. So have a little bit of a hip program, thoracic spine program, and a shoulder program, basically just to improve the things he was down on in his testing. So we spent 6 weeks on that, retested them. They were better. They weren't exactly where we wanted them. Some were up in the 85% in terms of limb symmetry, but some were still like 70%. I was like, okay, well, that's better. So we'll just go another 3 week block, and then because it was just before his pre-season in September, and then we'll try it again. So then at that point, I said to him, do you know how many shots you do in a game, in a normal match of this backhand thing? And he said, well, no, I've no idea. So we looked at the research and I can't remember off the top of my head. It was something in the region of 40 or 50 shots per game. The game's 90 minutes long. So I said, right, okay, well, in 90 minutes, you're doing 40 or 50 shots. That gives us a capacity measure. So one, can you do the movement? And two, how many do you need to do in a short space of time? So then we basically give him a dosage, reps and sets off the back of that. So I got him in the gym doing, so I kind of cable resistance, but in those patterns, just to try and build a strength up, combining all those buckets of exercises we did into one big global chain exercise. So the next 3 weeks, pushed his strength up. I think it's by the end of that 3 weeks, he was above 85% and doing all that full chain exercise with no problem at all. And that was the start of 2 seasons ago. He's now all on, he's been training pain-free now for the last 2 years. So, that was probably the best example I can think of in my head of how we kind of got him through. One, broken down the problem, then building back up again to be able to tolerate loading consistently all the way through that period. I think we then, after it was a maintenance piece, so we had a little bit of a warm-up exercise to do, which based on that drill, which kind of he still does now. Whether he needs to or not, I'm not sure, but he's just now got into the habitual pattern of going through these movements just to reinforce that pattern and keep his strength proper conditioning. So, that's probably a nice little example of how kind of broken it down and building back up again to deal with that, to deal with the problem.
Yeah. So you've literally looked at him going from looking literally at movement patterns, breaking it down. Like you said before, you work backwards for like a rehabilitation program, looking where people want to be eventually, and then you work your way backwards to understand like how specific you need to be in order for them to accomplish their goal. Breaking it down to that level of detail just shows you what kind of professional you are as well. It's absolutely mind-blowing and staggering just the level of depth that some practitioners go into. And I don't think people really appreciate the level of competence and patience as well as obviously the education side of things that practitioners like yourself put themselves through in order to help people. I think that speaks volumes about like your specific type of practice. And me going to meet you for the first time, every time I go and see you, it's a pre-consultation. Before you put a hand on me, you're talking to me for about, I say, half an hour, asking me all the questions. And I think that is something
that, nothing against other physios, but very often when I go to a physio, they'll be straight onto the massaging. And I just think, but you didn't know anything about my injury. So yeah, that's a massive testament to you. And so thank you. And then to finish off, I just want to ask you if you can give any details about yourself and where can people find or contact you?
Yeah, I think the main way to get in contact with me is probably via Instagram. That's where I'm most active in that space. I'm on LinkedIn as well, but I don't tend to go on there too much. But so my IG handle is @prepare_perform_recover. And that's where I'm more active at the moment. That's probably the best place to find me. Send me a message on there and then I can contact you if you want any questions or to contact me about anything at all.
Cool. Amazing. Thank you so much. Loads of detail there, lots of questions. I'll break this down in the show notes and also I'll obviously tag your socials. Highly recommend it. You're very, very, very recommended. And everybody, all of my clients, I send them directly to you. Anybody comes to me with an injury issue, client or not, is someone else's client, I always recommend you 100% of the time. So yeah, thank you so much.
No problem at all. I appreciate that, mate. I appreciate you inviting me on. Thanks for the big up.
Honestly, so cool. And best of luck with the Olympics as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram @rich_performance_nutritionist and feel free to drop me a message with your thoughts and feedback on this weekly chat so far.